Welcome to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast. My name is Dr. Andrew Tresida from NHS Somerset, and I'm joined by two colleagues and friends today. First of all, Peter.
Hello, Dr. Peter Bagshaw, GP and NHS Somerset Clinical Lead for Mental Health.
And Alka.
Hello, hello. Nice to be here.
Dr. Alka Patel, tell us a little bit about yourself, please, Alka.
Oh, wow. Where do I begin with that? What am I doing at the moment? Well, I'm practicing as a lifestyle medicine doctor is where my heart and my passion lie, on the background of having been a GP for more than fingers and toes than I've got now. So so that's where my where I'm at at the moment, Peter and Andrew.
And your clinical practice?
Yes, so most of that, I do work with NHS Practitioner Health as part of my NHS practice. I haven't had a seat as a GP on those 10-minute consultations for quite some time, and I run a kind of a private medical practice, clinical practice, really focusing on a lifestyle-first approach to health, so zoning in on lifestyle before prescribing, although there's an absolute place for medicine and drugs in healthcare. I truly believe that our lifestyle comes first, so that's where I tend to focus on.
Thank you. And you've kindly agreed to join us today to talk about one aspect of lifestyle medicine, which we all need to know about. And the title of today's talk is Alka on Alcohol. So alcohol matters. So tell us, you've researched this in detail. We all, culturally, it's quite accepted that many of us might use alcohol. But tell us, is that good for us? Is it bad for us? Is there something we should know? Are there lots of things we should know?
There are lots of things. And it's that some of that labelling, isn't it? We've got into this already. Is it bad? Is it good? And suddenly we want to sort of attach a label on it. And you're right. I mean, alcohol's been around for a long, 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 long time. And right at sort of its outset, it was actually used for medicinal reasons, things like sterilisation and cleaning. And we know it's used as reagents in labs. But I think most people are going to be much more familiar with how it's used to really alter that human state, that state that is really one of laughter and lightness. And that's what I think keeps us wanting to go back for more. So the question is really then, as you say, if this is a substance that gives us laughter and lightness in our life, and who doesn't want more of that, then what is the fuss? What's the harm with it?
Absolutely. So tell us more.
Yeah, so I guess when it comes to harm, I mean, we've got sort of very much guided by Public Health England and chief medical officers who over time have now said to us that 14 units of alcohol a week is a safe level. And I think it's really important to think about where this maybe comes from in terms of safety levels and thinking about, is it truly safe? And I think to get to that, we need to get to the sort of biochemistry of alcohol, first of all. So
before we do that, could you just explain what a unit of alcohol is?
Oh, yes. So you're right. This can get very complicated. We talk about units of alcohol quite a lot. So it's really a sort of measure of alcohol, really. So to simplify it, one unit is half a pint of beer or lager or cider.
One unit is 10 millilitres of alcohol, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So if you do that in practical terms, because it gets really difficult to sort of...
So it's done by percentage. So if you've got, let's say you've got 12% wine, then 1 litre of 12% wine would be 12 units. And a 750ml bottle would be 9 units.
Exactly. Having said that, how many people are at the bar or at the pub getting out their calculator and calculating that? So it's tricky, isn't it? So those kind of concepts of taking the percentage and measuring that and working out the units, it's great in theory, but on practical terms, I just don't find that people really do those sums at all. It's much easier, I think, to think of, here's a half a pint of beer, that's the unit, or here's half a glass of wine, that's the unit, and to think of it in terms of the actual consumption sometimes can get easier. And I think, quite rightly, as you sort of alluded to, people also tend to underreport and underestimate what they're drinking as well. So I think it's really important to be quite aware. As you say, there's a calculation involved. Keep it simple and have this sense of really sort of understanding units as well is important. Yeah.
So we've got this advice of 14 units a week. That's changed a bit, hasn't it? It used to be 21 for men. And there's a question mark over whether, for instance, pregnant women should drink any alcohol at all. How well evidence-based is it, do you feel? And what about these other questions of safety?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important thing to raise, is how come we've managed to get from 21 units to 14 units? You know, why have we been able to change that? And why haven't we got down all the way to zero units? Because really, alcohol, it has been classified as a carcinogen. And there's literature that backs up this as well. There's the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which has classified alcohol as group one carcinogen, meaning that it causes cancer in humans. And so this isn't sort of something to kind of approach as a scare tactic or any judgment in terms of how much you're drinking. But I think it's really important to have that knowledge that any level of alcohol has got a carcinogenic effect, and it's not necessarily a dose-related effect. And sometimes, you know, we don't want to know these things. We want to kind of enjoy that freedom and social ease at a party, and we want to have that glass of wine before we go to bed, or feel that we deserve to let our hair down. But I think, you know, it's really important to know that every decision you have has consequences. And this doesn't, of course, mean that everyone who drinks alcohol is on a path to develop cancer, because, of course, there's many people who drink very little alcohol who do develop cancer, and many people who drink a lot of alcohol who don't develop cancer. But whether it does or it doesn't, I think the important thing for everyone listening to know is that it can, any level of consumption really can cause cancer. And that's just one of the effects. I think there's about 60 medical conditions that have been directly associated with alcohol.
That's really interesting. And I'd love to come on to some more of those 60 medical conditions in a minute. But you were alluding to the biochemistry of what happens to alcohol in the body. What actually happens when we drink alcohol? Is it a food? Is it like an anesthetic agent? What's happening in our bodies?
Okay. So let's drop in maybe into some of the metabolism around alcohol.
Please.
So alcohol is a toxin. And the reason we know that it's a toxin is because the body has developed these mechanisms to get rid of it quickly. So we've got detoxification pathways. And there's two steps to this. So the first step, alcohol very quickly gets converted to acetaldehyde. So that's a molecule that's converted from alcohol by this enzyme called ADH. And unfortunately, although we like to think that human design is perfect, it does have its imperfections, because acetaldehyde, as it turns out, is even more toxic than alcohol. So you've got to get rid of that as fast as possible. So there's this second step when the acetaldehyde is then converted to acetate through another enzyme, ALDH. And then it's the acetate that's not toxic. So that gets then removed from the body as carbon dioxide and water.
I'm coming back to the health risks, and I don't want us to be completely negative on this, because otherwise the message is going to be none of us should drink any alcohol at all. But in terms of overall risks, you've talked about cancer. There have been question marks, haven't there, about, say, heart disease, for instance, and whether there's a J curve and whether maybe red wine is better than other sorts of alcohol. Do you have any views on that?
I think that's a really good point, Peter. I think there's so much literature on this that you're probably going to find whatever it is that you want to look for. So if you go down to constituents like resveratrol, which we know is found in red wine, and the benefits of that, they've been widely stated now. And in fact, it's becoming a very popular supplement as well, and has got a really good position in terms of reversing aging, which is one of my specialist fields as well, and longevity. But if you can really do understand the literature in a bit more depth, the amount of resveratrol in red wine that you need to consume for those effects is phenomenal. And in order to have that benefit, you end up having to go through some of the more negative consequences of alcohol. So I think, you know, we can find literature that supports sort of both sides of the argument in terms of, is alcohol safe or isn't it safe? But ultimately, when you're looking at what is the sort of possibility, what are the potential consequences, and what is the protection that I need, there is a lot more that says that alcohol has got effects at every single level. But because we don't all get the same effects and we don't all get the same long-term consequences, I think it becomes much more difficult to really extract, for me, what is my risk right now? And that's the most important thing. I think when you look at research, I find it's more important to look at that sort of N equals one approach rather than the whole sort of population effect in terms of those sorts of numbers.
Really interesting. So coming back to the N equals one, and thinking about the sort of small dose of alcohol and a moderate dose of alcohol and an increasing dose of alcohol, just a number of us may be familiar on a personal N equals one basis of what the effects of alcohol are, but just run us through what the general effects of a small dose are and a bigger dose and a very big dose and a huge dose.
Okay, so where should we go with that? Well, maybe having a look at sort of macro, micro effects at sort of brain levels might be helpful. I think there was a meta-analysis which was published in 2022. This was in the journal Nature, and that looked at over 36,000 adults, and it was looking at changes in brain volume and changes in the sort of white and gray matter of the brain. So thinking about that kind of microstructure. And what this found was that at an average dose of 1 to 2 units of alcohol a day, there were changes taking place in brain volume and in brain microstructure. And those changes increased with volume of consumption. So I think that what's important, back to sort of the, is 14 units safe or not? Well, we know that even at a small level, there's changes that are already taking place in the brain. And some of those are at the sort of at the neuronal level as well. So if we think about just even behavior and what happens when we see people who are drinking, we might be at a party, and you start off with one drink, and why is there a big difference between what you're like after one drink and what you're like after 6 to 7 drinks? And this is very much related to, if we look at some of the kind of GABA effects, so the which might be kind of useful to talk about. So if we think about the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, one of the things that's going on here is inhibition. So there's inhibitory circuits which are at play in your prefrontal cortex, and they're all mediated by GABA, so gamma aminobutyric acid, a chemical. And then what alcohol does is it lifts those inhibitory circuits, which is exactly why at parties and then at bars you start to see all that disinhibited behavior. I'm sure, like me, Andrew and Peter, you've noticed how the volume of conversation just gets louder and louder and voices get louder, or people start using their hands more and their arms more. And that's all physical disinhibition. And that's all down to that effect of GABA being lifted. And then what happens is you then start to get impulse suppression being lifted as well. So people start to do things without thinking it through. And then the memory circuits get affected. So alcohol's got this very strong effect on your neural networks that are also involved in memory formation and storage of memory. And many people listening may resonate with being out on a night out drinking and then forgetting parts of it. Or you've been with friends and they can't remember half the night. And that's the alcohol and the acetaldehyde effect on the neural circuits on your brain.
That's really interesting. And if I can just share some clinical work I used to do. I used to work in the police service doing forensic medicine. And I remember a fascinating lecture given by a drug and alcohol specialist in Somerset. And he said that research in Australia on postmortems on people who died in car accidents showed that if they drunk alcohol, there were micro hemorrhages in the mammillary bodies, even at quite young ages, and nothing to do with the traumatic effect of the accident. But that actually thiamine protects against this, and B vitamins generally can protect to a certain extent, but thiamine is particularly protective. And he also went on to say that I think it was in the 1970s, there was a move to actually get thiamine added to alcoholic drinks on the basis that it does protect against some of the acute brain damage. But unfortunately, there was a lobbying that stopped that for some reason. Peter, you're going to come in and ask and say something there.
Yes, if I can just add into that, Andrew, I've just been doing an article on dementia. And of course, one of the forms of dementia is Wernicke-Korsakoff's syndrome, which is absolutely that thiamine deficiency due to alcohol ingestion. So yeah, very, very definitely that has those effects.
And just thinking about that, what does it look like and is it reversible, Peter?
It's reversible in about a quarter of cases. You get an acute encephalopathy, so you become unwell. But then after that, it looks like just any other dementia where the brain isn't working properly.
Can you please unpack encephalopathy? I can't even say it. Can you please unpack encephalopathy for me, please, Peter?
I'm always asking other people to unpack things and then use a terrible medical term myself, don't I? So thank you for slapping me on the wrist for that. It's just a swelling of the brain that makes you acutely unwell. Yeah.
But isn't it crazy that we're talking about alcohol, and then in order for us to allow ourselves to consume even more of it, we'll just add something in that might help us to have even more of something which could potentially do us more harm. I mean, there's just craziness to it. And honestly, what really got me as well was when I discovered that a five-year-old legally can have alcohol in the presence of a parent. And it just, the law on that just, it's just so striking. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, most families don't do that, but they might because the law allows them to. But also, remember, we've got a lot of mirroring going on between those ages of 5 and 15. So there's something really important to really think about in terms of where the sort of law lies with alcohol and alcohol consumption as well, and what the impact on families is and children growing up as well, which we haven't talked about yet. But I think, you know, in terms of kind of the broader place of alcohol in society, and look, like you know, no judgment at all. I mean, I do drink alcohol at times. I'm the last one at the party, and at times I'm the one who doesn't drink and has just as much fun without drinking. So there's absolutely no judgment at all attached to this conversation at all. I do think it's important to share that with everybody, but there are some things that are really important and useful to ponder, I think, as well.
And I know a lot of people make the case that if it weren't for the historicity around it, it would probably be illegal because it's more harmful to both individual and societal. But can I just shift us around, given that we are where we are? The other aspect of alcohol is the question of addiction.
Yeah.
So can you give us a few pointers as to when we might be beginning to run into trouble, things that we can look at, maybe ways of finding out if alcohol is a problem at that level to us?
Yeah. No, that's a great place to move to, because I think we've talked about sort of alcohol and toxicity, but then how does that feeling of toxicity, I guess, translate into addiction? How do you know even if you've got an addiction to alcohol? Because there's lots of terms that are used around that as well, aren't there? So I like to talk about what I call the four C's. So this is craving, compulsion, consequence, and control. So craving is very much about that desire to drink. And then it's then followed by a compulsion, which is an urge that you just can't seem to overcome. And then when you do drink, you face the consequences. So these could be positive consequences because they satisfy that craving, or they could be negative ones like the impact on health and relationships and finances. But these negative ones are not strong enough to overturn the craving. So then what follows is issues of control. And you've got that loss of control as that spiral continues. And I think when it comes to sort of addiction, I think it's really useful to think about those four C's. And I know certainly in medical terms and medical practice, we've got this great questionnaire, haven't we? The audit questionnaire, which we use to try and identify addiction and identify it in people. So I think it's sometimes quite useful to go into some of those questions to understand how they fit into some of the features that we find in relation to addiction. So some of the questions on there are relatively straightforward. I think the first three are sort of fairly straightforward. How often do you have a drink containing alcohol? And we've alluded to question two, how many units of alcohol do you drink? And I think the third one is, how often have you had six or more units if you're female, and eight or more if you're male? And then we get into some of the sort of more nitty-gritty, I think, impact of alcohol itself, which I think question four is, how often during the last year have you found you're not able to stop drinking once you're started? And I think this is very important, because if you speak to addicts, they do report this feeling of not having an off switch. So just don't feel able to stop want to say start. I mean, I certainly have that feeling when I have a packet of sweets, you know, I get one and before I know it, the whole packet's polished off, or biscuits. You know, have you ever devoured a whole packet of biscuits? It's the same with alcohol. It's like you start off thinking, I'll just have one or two drinks, but you end up being the last person drinking, or you come home from a busy day of work and pour yourself a glass of wine because you just deserve it. And before you know it, by the time you get to bed, the bottle's empty. So I think that's a really important question that relates to craving and compulsion. You can't desire. And then the next questions, I think they all really relate to the consequences and control that I've mentioned. So question five is around how often have you failed to do what was normally expected of you because of your drinking? And again, speaking to addicts, the impact is on responsibility, on maybe not getting to work on time, not being able to pick up a child from school, missing a meeting, not meeting financial responsibilities. So this is a really important question that draws in on the impact of alcohol on day-to-day life and day-to-day experience. So I find this is a really important one to really drill into, so because it really does get to the sort of heart of the emotion that lies kind of around drinking and around alcohol, really. And then we've got a question, haven't we, around needing a drink in the morning to get going. And this is that that question around hair of the dog. It's a really interesting phrase. You probably come across it where, you know, you have a heavy night the night before and the next morning it's, oh, I'm off to have another drink because it's hair of the dog. And I looked into where this came from because, you know, hair of the dog, what on earth is that?
What does it mean? It's a very curious phrase. I've heard it, but what does it mean?
Yeah, it is. It is very curious. So it comes from a very old folk remedy for rabies, in fact, where it was thought that if you took a hair from the dog that bit you and put it into the wound, then it would heal. So it was really alluding to the principle of curing like with like. And then what happened over time, and sort of by the time sort of the 16th century came along, that metaphor then started to be used as a way of dealing with a hangover, like with like. So using drink to deal with drink. And I guess the question is, does this actually work? Like, what's the scientific basis to this? So this is where actually also very interesting, because what the science does tell us that alcohol causes vasodilatation. What that means is, well, vasodilatation is relaxation of your blood vessels, where your vessels will just dilate and open up. So if you think about a hangover, which more correctly, the term for hangover is post-alcohol consumption malaise. we prefer hangover. Well, if you think about that, the typical feelings you're getting are heavy head, headache, maybe stomach ache, fogginess, just not feeling great. And one of the reasons all of that occurs is because of dilatation and constriction of your blood vessels. So with vasodilatation, when you're consuming alcohol, you can get a sort of much more calmness and relaxation. So alcohol causes opening of the blood vessels, but then there's a rebound. So when the alcohol wears off, you get vasoconstriction, which is why you get that sharp, heavy head in the morning after the night before. And that's when some people think that hair of the dog, having another drink of alcohol, will help. And actually it might, because whilst you're drinking, if you think about it, you're vasodilating again. So that's why your headache can feel as though it's easing. Your head feels less heavy and less foggy. But after that drink, then the rebound's going to kick in again, back to vasoconstriction. So you end up going through this cycle. So overall, hair of the dog, bad idea. Bad idea. Actually, terrible idea, because ingesting more alcohol to recover from alcohol is really the thing that's going to prolong your hangover. So certainly not something that I would recommend. But there, interestingly, there is a science basis to it as well.
Interesting. It seems as though anything that we take from outside that makes us feel better at the time then has that downside after it wears off, doesn't it? So for people who maybe are aware that their alcohol consumption is a bit higher than they should do, want to find out a bit more, what help is there? Where can they go to find the audit C that you discussed, and what other forms of help are out there?
Yeah, I think the audit C is a really great place to start. And in doing it yourself, you can go online and you can Google it up, audit C, you'll get the questionnaire, you can answer those questions yourself. And I think also what's important following that is to not ignore the numbers and the scores. So first point of contact, I would suggest, would be your GP to have a conversation about alcohol. And I know this is an always the easiest thing to do, and it's not a conversation many people want to have. But that really does then open up the gateway to lots of support. So that's my little dogs crying out at my feet.
Lovely. So we start possibly by recognizing it. And we've looked at the audit, AUDIT, the alcohol use something, something, something tool online. We've perhaps gone to our GP. Are there, in Somerset, we've got the Somerset Drugs and Alcohol Service, but are there any other online online resources that people can access or learn more about?
There are sort of online online resources. I mean, I'm somebody who's very much a proponent of using sort of data and devices to support your own well-being and your own self-care. And there are some great devices, actually. We talked right at the beginning about tracking your alcohol. And there's this great little device that you can wear. It's a little bit like a wristband. It's called Skin. And it helps you to just monitor your alcohol consumption. Because I think once you take the sort of questionnaire, the great thing about taking questionnaires, and this particular one gives you sort of a number score with it, is I do find numbers give you a very strong nudge. They really give you that nudge to notice something that you might not have noticed before, to nudge you in the right direction. And then things like tracking, so thinking about tracking your alcohol consumption, can become something that you can get used to and want to do for your own safety as well as others, and also for a bit of curiosity, because the moment you start to track, you also start to change your behavior. So there's lots of apps as well that let you do that. There's an app called Less and one called Drink Less. That's been created by scientists at UCL, at University College London, where you can set targets, you can log your mood. And I think once you start to sort of really look at the effect that alcohol is having on you, I find that quite quickly behavior can start to change as well. So those are sort of a few kind of good resources that I found are helpful. But I think there is no substitute for specific support. I think tools are great for getting you to see your patterns and numbers to give you a nudge as well. But I think talking to somebody is the most important thing that you can do.
That's really helpful. So awareness is important. And certainly when it comes to abstinence, which may be a goal for some people, Alcoholics Anonymous has been very well known for many, many years as a 12-step organization and has great success in supporting people. There's a bit of a caution. I'm glad you mentioned going to the GP, because there is a bit of a caution. If we are alcohol dependent, is it a good idea to just stop like that on our own? Are there any dangers sometimes in stopping just like that?
No, and I'm glad you raised this, and I think that is why support comes into it at an early stage. I think it's really, really important to speak to your doctor about how you can reduce your consumption if that's what you want to do. Think about what your goal is and how you're going to do that in a supportive way. You mentioned already Peterson, thiamine and other things that can help to kind of support that. So I think, yes, you know, don't feel that you've got to go this journey alone. Going cold turkey on alcohol, as they say, can cause a lot of harm in terms of withdrawals. So again, looking at sort of some of the research in terms of overcoming some of those cravings, if you go back to some of the biochemistry, dopamine is a big molecule that's involved in why we seek out pleasure, and that's alcohol that's giving us the pleasure. And what some of the research has found is that in 30 days, it is possible to reach a dopamine reset. Now, it doesn't mean that everything related to addiction you can overcome in 30 days, but it does mean that sort of that craving, remember those four C's, that first part, you can overcome that. And of course, when you stop drinking, days 1 to 10 are very, very hard. Your cravings are high. You might get a lot of psychological and physical effects, headaches and shaking and sweating and restlessness and insomnia, which can really start within a few hours after you stop drinking. So if your consumption level is high, then I certainly wouldn't advocate doing this on your own, because some of these withdrawal effects can be very serious and you might need medical
Absolutely. They can include seizures as well. So if your body has become dependent upon alcohol, then rapid withdrawal is not a good idea without medical supervision. But maybe at a social level, then one can cut down relatively easily. What a fascinating talk we've had about this. Any last points you'd like to help us with, Alka? And any last points, Peter, from yourself?
Oh, gosh, we've covered a lot, haven't we? I mean, look, alcohol and alcohol addiction is a huge topic. So there's also many, many areas that we haven't covered as well. So I would just encourage people to look at the audit, see audit scoring, and think about those three C's, four C's, the compulsion, consequence, the control, the cravings, and start at the beginning. You know, this isn't about really make a decision for yourself. Do I want to reduce my alcohol or don't I? That's choice. And if you do, then start with the cravings and really think about how you're going to change that and affect that.
And medical advice, always useful.
Always, yeah.
Indeed. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. That's been really, really interesting.
Absolutely. Thank you very much indeed. It's a difficult topic to talk about rationally because it's so embedded in our social structure, but I think it's really important that we don't shy away from it. And thank you very much for giving us the science behind it all.
Oh, no, very welcome. It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast, hosted by our team of doctors from NHS Somerset, including Dr. Andrew Tresidder, Dr. Peter Bagshaw, and Dr. Sarah Cooper. The show was created by David Seeley and was produced by Rob Hunt's Music on behalf of the Somerset Clinical Commissioning Group.